Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. It's a wonderful chill Thursday night here. And as always, it's time for that part of the Thursday Live segment where we listen to Swami's discourses and try to absorb the beautiful and profound message Swami gives therein. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and to join me in this program today, we have Brother Hari Shankar from the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust. And before we begin this program, we offer our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet and pray to him that Swami speaks through us. Sairam Hari.
Oh, Sairam Prem. Thank you for having me on this week.
Yes, and it's a beautiful topic which you're going through. Of course, every discourse has been as revealing as the previous one.
Yes.
And the way beautifully Swami is going through these discourses, as we were just discussing some time ago, how Swami is going from a level to the other, you know, almost like how we studied maths in our schooling. You know, every time I see these discourses, that's the one which comes to my mind where, you know, when you study maths, when you learn addition, you felt that that's all maths had.
Yes.
And then you introduce subtraction. You said, oh, that's more interesting. And then you were told that, no, there is something called multiplication. And I'm sure that it's endless. you get differential calculus.
Yes, it's as if Swami is literally peeling the layers of knowledge,
right,
and revealing them one by one and letting us digest it bit by bit.
Right. And it's been such a wonderful pleasure going through this entire discourses.
Mm-hmm.
We've completed 8 discourses. And we've attempted something like a comprehensive summary. I don't know how well that went. And now we have the 9th discourse, which means we have the second half of the whole series, the 16 discourses in all, and now it's the 9th discourse.
Right.
And Swami is in that discourse, the theme is egoism and attachment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different word altogether. Egoism, what it means to a person, in a normal person in society who is living a regular life.
Yes.
Compared to one who has taken to the spiritual path, or even who has started the process of inquiry, isn't it?
Yes. So generally, we think of egoism as, we tend to associate this word with pride and arrogance. So we say a person is egoistic, and so then we say, yeah, he has pride or he has got arrogance. These are the qualities we associate. But here, when we say egoism, it is a very simple term. It just talks about your interpretation of yourself as a person that is different from the world around you. So as an individual that is separate from the world. So egoism is just, you can say it is merely the sense that I am. And then there is, you see, the moment you say I am and you see a world around you, you classify that as the other.
Right.
So that is the egoism that is talked about. And likewise, attachment, it comes as an attachment to egoism. And the sense of mine, something that belongs to me, as distinct from something that belongs to others, is something that arises almost spontaneously with the idea of I.
Right. In fact, you know, when Swami is going through these discourses, one thing which, to put it in a sentence, Swami talks about body.
Mm-hmm.
Swami says it is an instrument, it is a kshetra, it's a dwelling place for the Atman.
Okay.
And then Swami talks about the senses. They are important because that is the window between the world and the body.
Mm-hmm.
The interior and the exterior is connected through the senses. And then Swami says the senses by themselves are powerless because they don't have the ability to choose.
Mm-hmm.
They just go by their utility. And then Swami says, to make that decision, or that which actually processes what the senses give, is the mind.
Right.
And then Swami says that mind is also something, a functional entity.
Yes.
And then Swami spoke about buddhi, that buddhi is the one which decides what is right, what is wrong, what is enough, what isn't enough, and what is more important, what is less important. And then Swami gave this beautiful analogy of, you know, how the sun illumines the moon sends the light forth, and in the night, your street is lit by the moonlight.
Yes.
And Swami said, similarly, the Atman actually illumines the buddhi.
Yes.
The buddhi illumines the mind, and the mind illumines the senses and so forth. And Swami said, but between the Atman and the buddhi, that which shadows the light which comes from the Atman is this subtle ego.
Yes.
So that's how Swami put ego in this whole discussion of what Swami have gone through in this discourse. And that explains it, you know, that which actually propels you to act, that which actually gives you the motive to gather or grab or do good or do right, do wrong, that feeling is this feeling of individualistic the feeling that I'm an individual,
exactly,
separate from what is around.
Even as you were saying this, one example that came to mind. So when I was very young, I used to be a great fan of the stories of Sherlock Holmes.
Okay.
And if you see, like, Sherlock Holmes is a very special person because he has very keen sense of observation.
Right.
And of course, as a youngster, I was always trying to develop that, like, how can I become a detective with that keen sense of observation and deduction. But now, even as you are speaking, I realize if I juxtapose or if I contrast how Sherlock Holmes was in relation to Watson. So the reason that somebody like Sherlock Holmes his brain is such that, or his buddhi works in such a way as to be able to look at, sift through all the different sensory stimuli that come in and look for what is important, is first because he calls himself as a detective. He says, I, Sherlock Holmes, I am a detective. That comes first.
Okay.
Which is the reason why his, you know, buddhi chooses to take in all the sensory stimuli in that particular way. Whereas Watson has a different way of describing himself. So he's perhaps saying that I am a doctor, I am a surgeon. So his way of looking at a person is entirely different from the way that Sherlock Holmes would look at. So that's why that sense of I am and what that I am says about itself comes way before, you know, the buddhi and the mind, you know, or the intellect.
And it's very profound what you said, because one of the techniques which Swami gave in silencing the mind, or instilling the mind, Swami says, tell yourself that I'm not an animal, I'm a man.
Right.
You know, the identification problem has to be sorted out first.
Absolutely.
And Swami says, then you take it forward to, I'm not man.
Yes.
I am.
Yes.
Swami says, you know, go to that state. Because there are states even in your daily living,
yes,
where you detach yourself from this body, from this existence. And of course, it's easy to talk about, but isn't it very difficult to comprehend what that state is?
Yes, but that is the exercise which you must constantly keep doing, because as you said, you know, being able to look at who you are defining yourself to be, I am this or I am that, and everything else follows from that. Your actions, your words, your thoughts.
Right. It's like a student. A student who is studying for medicine.
Yeah.
And maybe a student who is studying for what somebody would call a lesser degree.
Yeah.
Both are students. Both are dependent on their parents.
Mm.
But what one is studying for makes him special than the other.
Exactly.
And you know, we might be in the same state mentally, but maybe to start with, as Swami says, that Shraddha, that desire to reach that state, maybe will qualify you a little more than somebody who is in a similar state but may not be thinking of such things.
Yes. So the earnestness, I think that is the defining quality as far as we are concerned. Like, even though, as you say, we may not have reached that level, or as it may be really so difficult in our daily lives, but it doesn't stop us from trying.
Right.
And I think dwelling on this discourse and what Swami is going to speak about in the section that we are choosing to discuss today, I think that is really part of that process.
Right. And maybe we'll quickly go through what Swami said in a couple of clips which we played last week.
Yeah.
Swami starts with that wonderful padyam, as always. I think it's there in some of the verses which Shankaracharya also has written, the Nirvana Shatakam.
Yes.
Something similar to that, where Swami says, I'm not the merit that I've done. I'm not the sin. I'm not happiness. I'm not sorrow. I'm not Vedas. I'm not the yajna. I'm not the food that I eat. I'm not the one who enjoys the food.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm Satchidananda. And he says, you know, the above mantra is applicable to everybody. Just because Swami is standing at the podium and saying, it's easy for us to say that, yes, of course, Swami is all this.
Yes.
You know, Swami can say all this. But the very next statement, Swami says, that whatever I've said now applies to all of you. And then Swami goes on from where he left the previous discourse, where he speaks about Satyam and Ritam being important.
Uh-huh.
And where the mind should always remain in that state of oneness.
Yes.
Whether you really realize that or not, to have that as the guiding principle of your actions, to believe that. And I think one of the discussions we had before might not be in the same forum in the afternoon satsang. I remember you making a very profound point about distinguishing feelings and emotions which we talk of as negative and those which we talk of as positive.
Yes, so I remember this, like, just now when you brought it up. So most of us, we tend to think in very moralistic terms. We say we term certain actions or certain emotions as good and certain emotions and certain acts of ours as bad.
Right, every day we do that, right?
Yes, But if you see that each, if you look at this whole thing in a very different way, and if we look at certain acts which are consistent with us believing that we are just the body and the mind, that we are merely this individual composed of the body and the mind. And there are certain kinds of actions which are very closely linked to an idea that we are beyond this body and the mind. We are beyond just this individual. So the definition of who we are is a much larger definition. So if I look at, for example, feelings of, say, selfishness, jealousy, envy, anger, these are so consistent with myself thinking of being composed of just this body and the mind.
Right.
Or me as an individual is composed of the body and the mind. Or a little larger definition of just being me.
Concerned about the family.
Yes, my family, you know, or my religion. And feelings of compassion, of peace, of love, of actions that you wish to bring freedom to the world. You want to rid the world of suffering. These come from a very different place.
Right.
So that was one of the things that we had discussed in that particular session.
Right. And yeah, putting it in a different way, it means that every emotion which we might remotely call negative also will have its basis on the feeling that you are an individual, that feeling of you are separate from the others around you.
Yes.
And the more you move towards the feeling that all are one,
yes,
and you, all these emotions of compassion, of sympathy, of empathy, you know, being good and being kind and all that comes, because your happiness now depends on more than yourself.
Yes, as someone once said, you are always going to be selfish.
Right.
It's just that definition of what that self is that will distinguish who you are, as whether you are a humanitarian or you are a person who is always looking for, or a hedonist.
Right.
You know?
I think that's what even Dalai Lama has said once, I believe. The highest selflessness is highest selfishness.
Highest selfishness, absolutely. Yeah.
And the other very beautiful point which Swami makes here is, you know, about man being an animal which is after happiness. Of course, Swami doesn't say animal. Man being a being which is always after happiness.
Yeah.
And Swami puts it very beautifully, saying that, you know, a man is walking down the street. And if he's happy and if he's peaceful, no one will come and ask him, what's the secret of your happiness? Why are you happy? But if he's looking morose, if he's looking downcast, people will always come and ask, what happened? Why are you sad?
Yes.
Because being happy or being in a state of comfort is not something which is unnatural to man.
Yes. Bliss is a natural state of, happiness is a natural state of a man.
Right.
Yeah. So, this, as you can see, the very, as I was going through the first part of the discourse, and practically every discourse that Swami talks about, it is basically leading man to the secret of that happiness. Because Swami, in his compassion, he sees us, watches us suffer needlessly because of the kind of thoughts that we have or the kind of actions that we undertake. And he, every discourse is an attempt to clarify that intellect for us. So, as you can see, the end part of the discourse, of the poem that Swami recites at the beginning.
Right.
And Swami says, like, I am neither merit nor sin, neither happiness nor sorrow. So Swami says that the basis for happiness is basically distinguishing what you are not. And I think that
neither happiness nor sorrow. Because if you're walking down the road and laughing or giggling to yourself, even then people will think something wrong with you.
Yes.
So it is actually the state of being at calm, at peace. That is which is the natural state.
Yes.
And when you're able to be in that endlessly, I think that is what Swami would refer to as ananda, or you know, complete state.
Yeah.
And then Swami goes on to the story of the debate between Shankaracharya and Mandana Mishra. I think historically this is more of a debate between an Advaitin or a Vedantin and one who believes in materialism, isn't it?
Yes. So at that time, the prevalent philosophy in India at that time was to believe in rituals as the means to achieve godhood,
right,
to divinity. So Shankaracharya, he revived an interpretation of Upanishads. See, this also was a valid interpretation. You can actually read the entire Brahma Sutras or the Upanishads and interpret it completely in the form of karma.
Yeah, right. That's why it's called Karma Kanda also.
Karma Kanda. And Shankaracharya, he revived a more esoteric interpretation of Upanishads, equally valid, which is to talk about the being, the Atma. So at every point of time, going back to the individual is not merely an individual that is separate from God, as never being separate from the from divinity,
right.
Always being the self, always being the Atma. So this is, as you said, a debate between this line of thinking and the karma, the Advaitic line of thinking and the karma kanda line of thinking.
Right. I think much later we had the concept of Vishishtadvaita also coming in. Well,
yeah.
I think there was one school of thought which said that God and creation can never be one.
Yeah, they're forever separate.
Forever separate. Then the middle path of the Vishishtadvaitins, who said that yes, we are separate, but
yes,
with effort, with sadhana, with spiritual, the process of spirituality, you can reach that oneness. But then the Advaitins, the school of Shankaracharya, which said that it is always one, but it is illusion which causes this apparent duality.
Separateness, yes.
Right. So I think that is where we were, and Swami spoke of how, and a very interesting thing which Swami said about how Ubhaya Bharati, the wife of Mandana Mishra, actually comes in to mediate between the two, or
right,
be the judge.
Right.
And it's a very beautiful symbolism, because what Swami often refers to this episode to draw the point that the importance that women were given in the
society
then.
Okay.
You know, that's a misconception which we have, that women were kept away from education and they were not
repressed.
But it was not true. And Swami quotes many women, and one among them is Ubhaya Bharati, where he says.
Right.
And the other point is Swami says here is, you know, who would agree for a settlement like this? You're debating with a man. Who will accept that that opponent's wife come and be a judge?
Judge, yeah.
You know, it only shows two things. One thing is the faith that he had in the righteousness of Ubhaya Bharati.
Yes.
And the second thing is the confidence he had in himself, Adi Shankara, in
yeah,
the philosophy that he was bringing to debate on.
Yes, sir, as he says, it's a testament to Ubhaya Bharati's fairness, her sense of justice.
Right.
Yes.
So I think that's pretty much where Swami stopped the clip last time.
Right.
So maybe quickly we'll go to the next clip in this discourse.
Yes.
And I see a lot of heavy terminology here. And let's hope we can understand what Swami is telling and at least pray to Swami so.
Right.
Anaga, Shankaracharya's swabhavam emiti. What is the nature of Shankaracharya? Medha sakti kante buddhi yokka sakti చాలా ఉత్కృష్టమైనటువంటిదని, శక్తివంతమైనటువంటిదని భావించి ఆ యొక్క ఉభయ భారతిని నిర్ణయం చేశాడు.
శంకరాచార్య డిసైడెడ్ ఉభయ భారతి టు బి ది జడ్జ్ బికాస్ హీ అండర్స్టూడ్ దట్ ది పవర్ ఆఫ్ బుద్ధి ఈజ్ మోర్ ఇంపార్టెంట్ దాన్ ద పవర్ ఆఫ్ మేధస్.
కనుక మేధస్సు కంటే బుద్ధి చాలా శక్తివంతమైనటువంటిది అనేటువంటి సత్యాన్ని గుర్తించాలి విద్యార్థులు.
Therefore, students have to realize that the power of intelligence, that is buddhi, is far
superior.
This is not the type of buddhi which is ordinarily understood.
Astha, 8, swastha, swane 20, asakti, tirattamu, kudina 20 yokka, shantiye ee buddhi.
The real intelligence of buddhi is associated with asakti and steadiness.
Rutamu, satyamu, rendintito, yeki bhavinchinatvanti yokka, suddhame ee buddhi.
That intelligence is purified by the association of rutam and satyam, truth.
Inga yogamu, mahattaramaina shakti, mahattattvamu. ఈ రెండింటితో కూడినటువంటి యొక్క పవిత్రమే ఈ యొక్క బుద్ధి.
దిస్ బుద్ధి ఈజ్ ది వెరీ ఎంబోడిమెంట్ ఆఫ్ ద ప్యూరిటీ అండ్ ది సేక్రెడ్నెస్ అసోసియేటెడ్ విత్ యోగ అండ్ మహత్తత్వ.
బుద్ధి అనగా కేవలం ఆలోచన శక్తి మాత్రమే కాదు.
బుద్ధి హియర్ డజంట్ రెఫర్ టు మియర్లీ థింకింగ్ పవర్.
కేవలం విచారణ శక్తి మాత్రమే కాదు.
ఇట్ ఈస్ నాట్ మియర్లీ పవర్ ఆఫ్ డెలిబరేషన్.
కేవలం వివేక శక్తి మాత్రమే కాదు.
ఇట్ ఈస్ నాట్ ఈవెన్ ది పవర్ ఆఫ్ డిస్క్రిమినేషన్.
కేవలం విజ్ఞాన శక్తి మాత్రమే కాదు.
ఇట్ ఈస్ నాట్ ఈవెన్ ది పవర్ ఆఫ్ సైన్స్.
విచక్షణ శక్తితో కూడినటువంటి విచారణ శక్తి.
ఇట్ ఈస్ దట్ పవర్ ఆఫ్ థింకింగ్ విచ్ ఈస్ అసోసియేటెడ్ విత్ పవర్ ఆఫ్ డిస్క్రిమినేషన్.
ఈ వాదనను పురస్కరించుకుని ఉభయ భారతి మండలి మిశ్రుని ఓటమికి అంగీకరించింది.
ఉభయ భారతి అగ్రీ దట్ మండన మిశ్ర వాజ్ డిఫీట్,
అనగా తన భర్తనే ఓడిపోయినట్టుగా అంగీకరించింది.
ఆఫ్టర్ సీయింగ్ ది ఆర్గ్యుమెంటేషన్ షీ డిసైడెడ్ హర్ ఓన్ హస్బెండ్ వాజ్ డిఫీటెడ్.
ఇది సత్య రుతంతో కూడినటువంటి నిర్ణయం.
దిస్ డెసిషన్ ఇస్ బేస్డ్ అపాన్ సత్యం అండ్ రుతం.
దీనికి శంకరులు చాలా ఆనందించాడు, ఆమెను అభివందించాడు.
శంకర వాజ్ ఎక్స్ట్రీమ్లీ ప్లీజ్డ్ విత్ హర్ కెపాసిటీ టు డిసైడ్. ఇంతటితో
పోక ఉభయ భారతి, నిర్ణయానుసారము నీవు శంకరుల వారికి దాసుడు కావాలి, శిష్యుడు కావాలి, సన్యాసమును స్వీకరించమని ఆదేశించింది.
షీ ఆర్డర్ దట్ అకార్డింగ్ టు ది అగ్రిమెంట్ మండల మిశ్రా షుడ్ బికమ్ ఏ డిసైపుల్ ఆఫ్ శంకరాచార్య అండ్ యాక్సెప్ట్ దిస్ సన్యాసత్వ
మాట. సత్యము అనగా చెప్పిన దానిని చేయటమే సత్యము, తలచిన దానిని చెప్పటము, చెప్పిన దానిని చేయటమే వృతం.
డూయింగ్ వాట్ యు సే రెఫర్స్ టు సత్యం, ట్రూత్.
కనుక నీవు ఈ యొక్క నిర్ణయానుసారంగా సన్యాసం స్వీకరించమని ఆదేశించింది ఉభయ భారతి.
షీ ఆర్డర్డ్ యాజ్ పర్ ది డెసిషన్ టేకప్ సన్యాస.
కానీ గృహస్థ ధర్మమునందు ఇల్లాలు, ధర్మపత్ని, గృహలక్ష్మి అనేటువంటి యొక్క బిరుదును అందుకున్నందుకు, లోకంలో స్త్రీజాతికి సరైన ఆదర్శాన్ని అందించాలనేటువంటి ఉద్దేశంతో తన భర్త సన్యాసి అయినప్పుడు తాను కూడాను సన్యాసి కావటం సహజమని భావించి ఆ ఉభయ భారతి కూడాను సన్యాసాన్ని స్వీకరించింది.
ఉభయ భారతి యాజ్ షీఈస్ గృహలక్ష్మి అండ్ ధర్మపత్ని, ఇట్ వాజ్ హర్ డ్యూటీ టు ఆల్సో బికమ్ ఏ సన్యాసిన్ వన్స్ హర్ హస్బెండ్ బికమ్ సన్యాసి.
భర్తను అనుసరించడము భార్యల యొక్క సహజము.
ఇట్ ఈస్ ది డ్యూటీ అండ్ ఇట్ ఈస్ న్యాచురల్ ఫర్ ద వైఫ్ టు ఫాలో.
ఆమె నిజముగా సన్యాసం స్వీకరించనక్కరలేదు.
దెర్ వాజ్ నో నీడ్ ఫర్ హర్ టు యాక్సెప్ట్ సన్యాసిన్ అట్ ఆల్.
కానీ లోకాదర్శన నిమిత్తమై తాను సన్యాసమును స్వీకరించింది.
ఇన్ ఆర్డర్ టు సెట్ ఎన్ ఎగ్జాంపుల్ ఫర్ ద వరల్డ్ షీ యాక్సెప్టెడ్ సన్యాస.
పరిశుద్ధ హృదయురాలు ఉభయ భారతి.
ఉభయ భారతి వాజ్ ఎ ప్యూర్ హార్టెడ్ సోల్.
ఆమె ఒక ఆశ్రమం నిర్ణయించుకుని కేవలము మేధాశక్తిపై ఆధారపడి మేధాశక్తి చేత జయ విజయాలను పొందాలనేటువంటి యొక్క అపేక్షలు కలిగినటువంటి యొక్క అహంకార వ్యక్తులకు సరైనటువంటి మార్గం నిరూపించాలనేటువంటి సంకల్పం తాను చేసుకుంది.
షీ రిజాల్వ్ దట్ హర్ హస్బెండ్ హూ వాజ్ బేసింగ్ ఆల్ హిస్ స్కాలర్షిప్ ఆన్ మేధస్ షుడ్, హూ ఈస్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ ఈగో, షుడ్ బి టాట్ ఏ లెసన్ అండ్ షీ గేవ్ ది కరెక్ట్ డెసిషన్.
తాను ఆశ్రమం నిర్మించుకుని ఆశ్రమం నుంచి నదిలో స్నానం చేసే నిమిత్తమై తనను అనుసరించేటువంటి కొన్ని శిష్యురాళ్లతో ఆమె ఒకనాడు బయలుదేరింది.
దే బిల్ట్ ఎ హెర్మిటేజ్ బై ది సైడ్ ఆఫ్ ఎ రివర్ అండ్ అలాంగ్ విత్ ది అదర్ డిసైపుల్స్ దే వుడ్ గో టు ద రివర్ అండ్ బేర్ ఎవ్రీ డే.
మార్గ మధ్యము లోపల సర్వసంగ పరిత్యాగి అని పేరుగాంచినటువంటి ఒక సన్యాసి.
దేర్ వాజ్ ఎ సన్యాసిన్ హూ వాజ్ ఫౌండ్ ఆన్ హర్ వే టు ద రివర్.
నీరు త్రాగేటువంటి ఒక తొరకాయ బుర్ర అంటారు తెలుగులో.
ఇట్ వాజ్ ఎ వెరీ ఆర్డినరీ టైప్ ఆఫ్ వాటర్ జగ్ వాజ్ దేర్.
తీరుని ఎక్కడైనా బయట పెడితే ఎవరైనా దొంగిలిస్తారో ఏమో అనేటువంటి ఒక భయం చేత, దానిపైన ఉన్నటువంటి అభిమానం చేత ఆ సొరకాయని తల క్రింద పెట్టుకుని పండుకున్నాడు ఈ యొక్క సర్వసంగ పరిత్యాగి.
This great sannyasin who had given up everything was attached to that small ordinary water jug. Fearing that that may be stolen away by someone else, he used it as a pillow and he was sleeping on that.
అతనికి సరియైనటువంటి జ్ఞానోపదేశం చేయాలని సంకల్పించుకుంది ఉభయ భారతి.
ఉభయ భారతి డిసైడెడ్ దట్ షీ షుడ్ టీచ్ హిమ్ ది కరెక్ట్ పాత్.
అతను వినున్నట్టుగా తన యొక్క శిష్యురాళ్లతో చెప్తుండాలి, చూడవే అతను సర్వసంగ పరిత్యాగి కాని సొరకాయ పైన మాత్రం అభిమానం వదలలేదు.
ఇన్ ది హియరింగ్ ఆఫ్ దట్ సన్యాసి హూ వాజ్ జస్ట్ స్లీపింగ్, షీ బిగాన్ టెలింగ్ హర్ డిసైపుల్స్ Look at this particular person. He has given up everything in the world, but as attachment
to this.
If he has so much of attachment for such a small petty thing, how much more of attachment would he have on more important things? She commented. His action is not in tune with the ashram he has accepted. This person who has renounced everything, he heard it.
Manasulo chala badha udrekamu rendu kudunu cheripoyayi.
He was filled with anger and also excitement.
Okka stree nannu intati maata antama ani tanalo okka vidhamaina deshaanni kudunu abhirudhi parchukunnadu.
He developed a sort of anger and hatred against her. After all, a woman commenting upon me.
తిరిగి తాను స్నానం చేసి వచ్చే సమయం లోపల నా త్యాగం ఎట్టిదో చూడు అన్నట్టుగా ఆ తల క్రింద ఉన్నటువంటి సొరకాయను తీసి ఆమె పాదాల దగ్గరికి విసిరి వేశాడు.
When she was returning after bath from the river, the moment she approached him, he threw away that particular jug at her feet, declaring, "Look at my renunciation. I don't care for this thing." He threw it away.
అప్పుడు ఉభయ భారత్ చెప్పింది, అయ్యో పాపం, వట్టి అభిమానమే కాదే అహంకారం కూడా ఉంటుండాలి అనింది.
దెన్ ఉభయ భారతి కామెంటెడ్, వెల్ యు నాట్ మియర్లీ హ్యావ్ అటాచ్మెంట్ బట్ హ్యావ్ యువర్ ఫుల్ ఆఫ్ ఈగో ఆల్సో.
ఈ అభిమానం అమకారములని అహంకారం అనేటువంటిది మానవునికి ఉండినంత వరకు కూడాను ఆత్మను అర్థం చేసుకోలేరు, ఆత్మానందాన్ని పొందలేరు అనింది.
హి ఆల్సో సెడ్, as long as men have attachment and ego and mindness, they would never be able to realize atma.
ఈ సత్యాన్ని సర్వసంగ ప్రత్యాగి గ్రహించాడు.
This great renouncer of the world realized the truth.
పరిగెత్తి వచ్చి ఆమె స్త్రీయ పురుషుడా అనేటువంటి విచారణ జ్ఞానమే చేయకుండా పాదముల పైన పడ్డాడు.
She ran to her, fell at her feet, not caring whether it was a man or a woman.
నా దోషమును క్షమించమన్నాడు.
Forgive my fault, he said.
That was that wonderful story. And you know, even as I was listening to that story, it just fills me with how much Swami fits in one story. And sometimes he narrates it with so much detail that you have the ability, he has the ability to carry you away with it.
Yes. I think some very important points which are very useful for us in our everyday life as well as, you know, our spiritual journey. The very first, actually it is a continuation of what Swami was talking about in the previous part of the discourse. And here Swami talks, places a lot of emphasis on distinguishing, or rather placing buddhi on a higher pedestal than intellect.
Right. Mirrors.
Yes. So actually in the previous part of the discourse, Swami is already saying that Ubhaya Bharati was somebody who embodied this particular relationship between buddhi and medas. So while her husband Mandana Mishra was a person who possessed great intellectual capabilities, it was Ubhaya Bharati who not only had that intellectual capability but also had the power of discrimination or buddhi. Her intellect was tempered by buddhi, and which is the reason why Shankaracharya was able to place a trust on her, that she would be able to discriminate as to what is right and what is wrong, and be able to be an impartial judge to the a debate which had a lot of stake.
Right.
And so this emphasis is like, Swami, you should remember that he is actually delivering it to students. And it is so important because this is a time in our society that we place so much emphasis on merely possessing intellectual capabilities, and we do not try to coach students or train students in being able to temper that with a certain amount of discrimination. Like what we call as integral education, which we follow in our
university.
It does that. It tries to balance out giving the day-to-day knowledge that we need to live our life with this discriminative power.
Right.
So that is something which modern education, there is a small failing in there, that we emphasize so much on converting that intellectual ability into success, fame and wealth, which are all accrued only to us, only to that particular individual or his family. So, buddhi, as perhaps if you take the example of youth, let us consider a sportsman, for example.
Right.
Let us take cricketers. Now, if we look at, say, somebody like Sachin Tendulkar, and he's obviously well-liked, a very capable cricketer, but I'm pretty sure that there were so many, contemporaries of his who must have had equal ability. And what is that which separated Sachin Tendulkar from the rest of the crowd? That perhaps they had the same eye for the cricket ball as Sachin Tendulkar had, and perhaps they exhibited the same amount of talent in practice in the field.
Right.
And I remember that there used to be a player called Vinod Kambli who was very, very, he had played with Sachin Tendulkar, practiced under the same, and practiced under the same coach, and he was always talked about as having very similar capabilities as Sachin. But you see, cricket, when it is played on the field, on the pitch, it converts from a game of your talents and your capabilities entirely into a mental game.
Mm-hmm.
How in a crowd which is with so much pressure on you, which adulates you so much, and you know you have to perform to that crowd, and you are looking at bowlers of equal or greater talent, how do you now in this situation, how do you hold yourself together and play? You see, how do you concentrate only on that ball that is coming towards you and play? So that is where buddhi comes in. That is the discriminating power which allows you to use your medhas, your intellectual and your other talents in a well-directed manner. That is where it comes. Or if you can take again an example that is relevant to youth, would be your studies, there are so many things that you are good at, but if you can use your buddhi at that moment to judge what is it that you need to do, what is most appropriate to do.
Right.
So that is where the buddhi comes. And here, Swami actually, he is distinguishing some characteristics of this buddhi. So we talked about two aspects, swastha and sthiratva, that is firmness or steadfastness. That I think is covered in the example that we just talked about. And there is this... There is something that I wanted that came to me as Swami was giving this, talking about buddhi and medhas.
Mm-hmm.
An example of two scientists.
Okay.
These are two scientists who developed the polio vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin. These were two, they were contemporaries. In fact, both of them, they are from American universities. And they developed the polio vaccine and today if you look at a country like India, even about a decade ago there was this fear that it would develop into an epidemic in India.
Okay.
And it was just as feared in the United States three or four decades ago. And because of these two scientists who developed the vaccine, which is an enormous success at that time, it was considered a breakthrough in medicine itself.
Okay.
And these two gentlemen, these two scientists, they had that humanity to say that we will not license this particular vaccine. So, as one article
they didn't patent it?
Yes, that is to say, they did not patent it.
They don't get the royalty.
Exactly. So, had they patented it, and they would have been able to get a royalty on every single time that particular inoculation or vaccination was done. And you can imagine the amount of difference that has made. So one article talked about how that foregoing that intellectual rights or patent on that reduced the cost of the medicine by about 25%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why even it could penetrate so deep into countries like India and several African countries. India is on the threshold of being declared a polio-free country in January 2014. If there's no incidence of polio, we will be declared a polio-free country. And likewise, our neighbor Pakistan is, India is supporting Pakistan in being able to become a polio-free country. Right. And such penetration would not have been possible had that vaccine been an expensive vaccine. And which can all be traced back to these two scientists saying that, in fact, Jonas Salk was asked, like, would you patent this particular vaccine? Mm-hmm. He said, it belongs to the people. Do you patent the sun? That's what very rhetorical question. And he said, it didn't even occur to him that such a thing should be done. So you see, they had the intellect, you know, they had, it was such a finely developed intelligence which could come up with this vaccination, a very breakthrough form of thinking of, you know, in vaccination, you introduce that virus back into the body.
Right.
And then have the body develop its defenses. So it's a very radical way of thinking. So it takes that kind of intellect to develop that vaccine. But it took that kind of buddhi, that discriminative power, which led them to think beyond themselves, to be able to give this benefit to the entire humanity, which and the world owes a lot to them today.
Right. In fact, I remember when, you know, we mentioned this before many times when Swami was here to inaugurate the studio.
Mm.
That's precisely what he said. Swami said, you have knowledge.
Yes.
Knowledge is available for anybody who is there to pursue it.
Mm.
But it doesn't stop there.
Yes.
Swami said, you have to skill that knowledge.
Yes.
You have to put that knowledge in such a way in use that it benefits people around.
Yes.
Swami said, when you skill that knowledge, people today are killing the knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, by using it for personal gains. Swami said, when you skill the knowledge, then it will lead to balance.
Yes. I remember an interaction that, a very interesting interaction I had when I first joined as a student here.
Okay.
in the university about a little more than a decade ago. So Swami was, I was a new student, and Swami, he inquired of me, so what did you do before you joined the Institute for MBA? So I said, so Swami, I did my engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami asked me, so what is this engineering? And I was just saying, Swami, it's an application of knowledge or science or something. Swami said, no. Engineering as it is practiced today is nothing but tricknology.
Okay.
He said, like, people are just using it to basically create products that trick each and every one of us. So, and when you say application of that particular knowledge, he said that when you apply it for the benefit of humanity is when it gets elevated to technology.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, it remains as tricknology.
Wonderful. You know, yeah, that's about Medas and Buddhi. But then Swami goes on to talk a little about egoism as such. You know, because the story which Swami is telling is very nice. You know, where
yes.
Swami is telling that there is a Sarvasanga Parityagi. That's how Swami calls this monk,
yeah.
One who has renounced everything. But he's so attached to that vessel in which you drink water. He's using it as a pillow when he's sleeping. You know, it actually gives a very profound message. But Swami is saying that ego can be so tricky. You know, you think that you've conquered it,
yeah.
But it can actually take a different form in it, and, you know, without your knowledge creep into you.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what happens here. Here is Ubhaya Bharati looking at this man and saying that, you know, he has after all not given up everything.
Mm.
And the moment he hears that, he breaks that pot.
Yes.
To kind of convince himself that, no, I have actually detached. But in the process, the ego takes the other form by saying that, now see, you're detached.
Yeah, and this actually brings about one important point, you know, the importance of a guru in one's life. Like, see, you said, Swami said rather, that he's a Sarvasanga Parityagi. So you can see this monk is there totally on his own and perhaps trying to discriminate and enter into that state of enlightenment. But it was a blind spot for him. He never realized that this jug, which is so to speak, his only position in the world, was still a sign of attachment. There had to be someone from outside, within quotes, who had to come and tell him that, you know, there is this one last barrier that you need to break.
Right.
Yeah. And again, one more facet of the guru. See, guru, we say in our ordinary parlance, a guru is compassionate towards a disciple. But this kind of compassion is a very distinct kind of compassion from what you and I show towards other people. So we could characterize the feelings of compassion that we normally experience, perhaps a sympathy or empathy, you know, any one of those feelings. But here, what they say, a guru is a person who has ruthless compassion towards his devotees. It's a very paradoxical, oxymoronical phrase to say that a guru has ruthless compassion. And it is compassion because it helps that in this case, this particular disciple or this particular individual to go beyond what state that he was in at that time.
Right.
But it is also ruthless. As in, she is not afraid to do it call out his deficiency in front of her disciples, you know, in front of everybody. It actually annoys him.
Absolutely.
And yeah, the only thing, you know, perhaps you and I also do this in our everyday life. We do ridicule somebody, but what distinguishes here is the result that she was able to obtain. Like, she was actually able to break a very significant barrier for that disciple.
Right. In fact, no, even as you were saying, I'm reminded of a discourse which Swami gave in the institute auditorium for the students.
Right.
Now, luckily, we have a copy of that.
Mm.
You know, in that, Swami starts in a very dramatic way where he says, people say anger is bad.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And Swami says, I say anger is good.
Okay.
People say compassion is good.
Yeah.
I say that compassion is bad.
Oh.
So that's how Swami starts. And then Swami, you know, dwells into it. Swami says, compassion that is misplaced is always harmful.
Right.
And anger that is selfless always results in good.
Right.
And Swami says, the anger of a mother is always selfless. And right. As you said, that is when it can achieve what is, you know, what it's meant for. Like,
absolutely.
In this case,
yes.
Where it was not to glorify oneself,
yeah.
And to say that, you know, I am able to find a fault in you.
Yeah.
Invariably, I think we do that generally,
yeah.
You know, and that's when it doesn't give the desired result. If I'm able to point out a mistake in somebody with absolutely no gain from it,
yeah.
You know, no feeding of my ego in the process,
yeah.
I think that's when it will actually have the best benefit.
Best benefit in the sense that the other person is able to get
exactly.
The benefit. See, even if, like, so-called, there is no material benefit that you get, you have the benefit of saying that I was right, finally, even to yourself.
Right.
Even
right.
If to no one else.
No, I told you. I told you.
And you need not have an audience. You can just pride yourself in that, yeah, I was right. And he's wrong, you know. So, also, like, one more, you know, thing that occurred to me over here. There are actually two stages in this particular event. If you look at it, the first part is Ubhaya Bharati pointing out to her disciples,
mm-hmm.
Of course, within earshot of that particular monk, that look, he has attachment towards that particular jug. So, this is what Swami terms as Abhimana.
Okay.
He uses the word Abhimanamu, and he says, like, or what we call as mamakara, that feeling of mine.
Right.
He has, and she says that this is what this particular person is individual is suffering from, that feeling of mamakara. And her next action is then to actually rile, you know, provoke that disciple to come back, you know, that devotee actually, that individual actually gets up and he says, you know, how can it be, how can this woman, how can she tell me what is right and what is wrong? And by this, she actually takes us to the origin as to how this phenomenon of mamakara or abhimana, what is at its root. And that is the feeling of ahankara.
Right, right.
So, this is a two-stage event and it brings out these two qualities which Swami says are the obstacles to us realizing our true self.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, that's one of the spiritual masters says that.
Hmm.
He says this very thing, you know, ego is a very funny thing.
Hmm.
He says, if you are a man who is doing well in business, if you are
right.
A rich man,
right.
You know, the ego will take the form that I am a rich man.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you renounce everything and you become a spiritual seeker,
yeah.
The ego will take the form that I am a spiritual seeker. See, he's still in the world. You know,
yeah.
Because it's so subtle and it can play on you.
Yes.
And there's a beautiful incident which one of our lecturers once shared with us.
Hmm.
We have narrated it many times here before, I think, but it's so beautiful because in this point which you mentioned that the guru can correct selflessly.
Yeah.
And that can make the difference.
That makes the difference.
That does make the difference. And also, when the disciple is able to see that selflessness in the guru, he can benefit maximum.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, I'm reminded of this particular lecturer's father.
Mm.
He was a person who was absolutely perfect in his, you know, the way he had settled his life.
Yeah.
He had retired. He decided that he would put away money for his children and he would proceed towards the Himalayas and take up a spiritual journey.
Right.
And so he had decided that he'll come and tell Swami about his plan and take Swami's blessings and go. And Swami calls him for an interview. And he says, Swami, I've done all these arrangements. His children were studying in Swami's college.
Right.
And one of them was a lecturer. And he said, Swami, I've settled all this. I've sold away my house and everything is done. And I'm ready to go now.
Okay.
Okay, Swami said, do you have to go to Himalayas to realize yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Swami asked him, what are you going for? He said, Swami, I should attain Sakshatkaram.
Yeah.
Swami said, do you have to go there?
Yeah.
And then Swami said, if you go to Himalayas and do your sadhana,
yeah,
who is going to give you Sakshatkaram? This man said, Swami, you have to give me.
Yeah.
And Swami said, then if you stay here, can I not give it to you?
Yeah.
And this person said, yes, Swami, you can. So then Swami told him, you stay here and you do your sadhana here and do work for me. I will give you Sakshatkaram.
Right.
You know, that authority with which Swami said, I will give you.
Yes, yes. I remember this particular teacher, he had told us.
Yeah, and then, you know, after this, this man continued to be here. He was, and this lecturer of ours used to say, what a perfect spiritual aspirant he was, because he would wake up 3:30 in the morning, sit for meditation for 2 hours, 3 hours, then do suprabhatam, and, you know, would have a very strict, regimen in his life, a very strict, self-disciplined man. And he was going like this for a few years. He was working in the PRO office, I think.
Right.
He was there for a few years. Then one fine day, Swami calls him for an interview. And all alone, closes the door. And Swami looks at him and says, how long are you going to continue in kindergarten? And that's how Swami starts the dialogue. How long are you going to continue in kindergarten?
Yeah.
And this person is perplexed and he says, Swami, I don't understand what you're trying to say.
Right.
Swami said, "Ye japalu, you know, bhajana, japalu. How many years are you going to continue all this?"
Yeah.
And this person is shocked. He's saying, Swami, dhyanam, japam, you always talk about it as important and all that, and that's why I do this.
Right.
Swami said, this is kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
Stop all this, he said. He said, okay, Swami, whatever you say.
Right.
And then Swami told him, you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning,
uh-huh,
you have your bath,
yeah,
come and sit on your corridor, on your veranda,
uh-huh,
and look at every person who goes by.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, the same Atma which is in him is the same Atma which is in me.
Wonderful.
And there is no difference.
Actually, what you told me reminds me of something that Divine Master once said. He said, like, if you look at all these spiritual aspirants, they're ready to give up anything. They're ready to give up riches. They're ready to give up their position, fame, name. They're ready to give up, you know, their lust and all these qualities. They'll give up everything except that one thought that they're not enlightened. So they'll, you know, that is that one thing that they'll firmly hold on to, and every single of their practices goes on reinforcing this one point. I'm not enlightened. I'm not enlightened. You know, so that is a very effective thing. Very effective instruction that Swami has given to that particular teacher.
Right, and you know, going back to that point, you know, that's what a guru can do.
Right.
You know, when he points out, maybe somebody else doing that will hurt.
Yeah.
But if you have that complete faith in that master that, you know, he is not doing anything which is actually even remotely selfish.
Yes. And one thing, like, we cannot judge a guru by his actions, because it is
right,
completely
right,
between the guru and the disciple. Like, I recall in one instance, this is between Swami and a particular student. It was during darshan time.
Mm-hmm.
So, Swami, this was a preparation for the very first Grama Seva.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami had instructed the students to get something from his residence in Purnachandra.
Okay.
And even as they're going, Swami had told them that there is some water had spilt, and Swami wanted them all to be very careful. But you know how students, how we all are, we want to show to Swami our devotion and how much enthusiasm we have in the work that he has given. And this one particular student, he ran back from the residence holding something in his hand. And he, in all his, you know, fervor to go towards Swami, he didn't see that puddle of water that was there in front of him. And within a few seconds, as you're watching, the saris that he was holding, it was all in the air. His legs were in the air and everything tumbled to the ground. And as watching Swami, the student was so dear to him. As watching, what would Swami's reaction be? Can you guess what Swami said next?
I mean, I have no clue. I'm really waiting to know.
Yeah, because, see, I expected that, you know, Swami, like he would go up. Yes, compassion,
right,
he would go up. Swami is very comical. Swami said, huh, exactly this should happen. You did not listen to me and this is what happened, you know. At that moment, I was a little bit taken aback, because I thought Swami should actually go and comfort the boy. But this, again, that aspect of ruthless compassion. See, when we do that to people, we are already treating that person as weak, as a person who cannot hold himself together and bring back, you know, come back to having sustained a fall that he cannot rise up again. But Swami made that boy rise up again and walk up to him and apologize for not having listened to his guru's words. So that was a lesson that had to be imparted that day, and the only way to do it was through this, that you have to implicitly obey the guru's words.
Just talking about this nature of a guru, I mean, somehow we've gone on to that.
Yeah.
No, I'm reminded of a devotee who was actually going through a very, very tough patch in her life, and there were problems, financial problems. Her husband was not having a job, and every time they would come to the family, would come to Swami and, you know, put forth their problems. Swami would give a solution.
Right.
Swami would give a solution or give a date. Uh-huh. You know, by this date, this is going to be fine, or your business is going to pick up by this date.
Right.
And those dates would just come and go.
Yeah.
And apparently it looked like Swami was, you know, literally lying to them. You know, whatever Swami was saying was not happening.
Mm.
You know, we often ask this, you know, Swami said this and it did not happen. And Swami
yeah.
said, I'll give you this tomorrow, and that tomorrow came and went.
Absolutely.
That's a grievance which all of us, in our ignorance, carry with us.
Yeah.
And so this lady, you know, had enough of this after a period of time.
Mm.
And she goes up to Swami and said, Swami, why do you lie to us?
Mm.
And she was very genuinely, and she was asking, because in the middle of all these problems, she said, Swami, why do you lie to us? Tell
yeah.
us this. You know,
yeah.
we learn morality and all that from you, but why do you lie to us? And Swami was not at all offended. You know, he was not hurt by the way this question was posed to him. He kept quiet, and she said, you tell me today, Swami, you say something, why doesn't it happen?
Mm.
You tell that things will change on such and such a date.
Yeah.
And, you know, why doesn't it happen? And Swami said, see, I know exactly when your problems will get solved.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I have to pull you through till that date.
Yes.
And whatever hope is required to you, I have to give it to you. And as a guru, my duty is to do whatever it takes
Wonderful.
To get you through.
Wonderful. That
and
is
if
so
that
profound.
Takes for me to lie,
yeah.
I will not hesitate.
Great. And even if I have to face that calumny, that
right.
accusation from the
accusation
very person.
From the very
to,
person, you know, the guru is helping.
Yes.
He says, I don't care.
Yes.
Because it is good for you, I will do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what is that ruthless compassion, as you
yes.
put it. You know, it doesn't care. It
even,
doesn't,
even for oneself.
Right.
I mean, for his own image and
you know,
his own. Yeah.
yeah typically, I used to imagine, you know, the child in the mother's womb, it might kick once in a while, almost saying that, you know, enough of this confinement, but the mother is not going to let out the child unless it's ready for it.
Exactly.
You know, the time is perfect for it. It's like
yeah.
that, the way Swami has taken care of all of us. I think it's something which everybody goes through, you know.
Yeah. It's what you said is so moving, honestly. And, see, we actually owe it to our mother, to Swami. This particular, the program itself is titled in that way, Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. And I recall, you know, some clippings. In fact, I think what Radio Sai had produced and shown once in one of the, you know, what shall I say, Mandir programs.
Okay.
And this is a clipping of Swami in the early days going to the villages. At that time, he would travel village
right,
to village, very, very punishing schedule. And he would speak to the, you know, give a public discourse to the villagers at that time. And of course, there was absolutely, it used to be unplanned. I mean, the villagers would get a few minutes notice that Sathya Sai Baba is coming to their particular village. There's no mic and no platform, no stage. And Swami would climb atop the car that in which he was traveling.
Right.
And from there, he would speak to the devotees. And you can imagine what kind of conviction, what kind of dedication that requires, if these can be applied to God. But Swami was demonstrating that what it takes, and it can only be a mother who does this. And it is our duty to kind of make that, you know, make sure that all that effort that you put in for each one of us, like that it should fructify. And the only way that it can is, like, he has given us so many discourses. Use this opportunity to churn that in our mind, which is the opportunity you have given me, for example, by having me on this program. But more importantly, to have what we discussed today being put into practice in our daily lives, in every little way that we can, every little effort, just to please him.
Right. And, you know, even as you said, imagining that rigor with which Swami lived his life, you know, how he stretched himself to the limit
yes.
to do. Of course, I find it very difficult to associate the word sacrifice with Swami, because sacrifice is for people like us, who we think that this is me and this is somebody else
yes.
and I have done something for the
for
other.
Someone else, yeah.
For Swami, it was never like that.
Yeah.
But seeing it from our standpoint, from the level we are in, you know, we we still believe that, you know, Swami is our master and we are the disciple, or Swami is the mother and we are the child. Hmm. Whatever is the relationship, I think as you said, it makes sense that we take whatever effort it takes to pay gratitude to whatever Swami has done, you know, and all this, and endlessly. If we look at this discourse, Swami said this in 1960, Swami said this in 1990, Swami said this in 2000.
Yeah,
exactly. And he repeated it endlessly, and we just hope that when we go through these discourses that we are able to do that mananam and, you know, pray that nididhyasanam happens.
Yes. And because the only happiness the child can give its mother by is it by itself being happy.
Right,
that,
right,
that is the only thing that Swami seeks for.
In fact, you know, that's you actually nailed it. And I remember Mr. Jim Sinclair, the millionaire from US, he says this, you know, that was one of the things which actually struck him. The first interview Swami called him for, and here was he, a millionaire who's ready to write a blank check to Swami and give whatever Swami asked for. You know, he could build a hospital if Swami wants.
Yeah.
And then in the interview room, he's all alone. And, you know, he asked Swami, what do you want? What can I do for you? What can I offer you? What is it that you expect from me?
Yes.
And Swami looked at him and Swami said, be happy.
That is all, yeah.
And you know, that is what actually struck him so much. He said, here is somebody who can really, you know, expect nothing out of me but happiness.
In fact, this brought to mind one very, you know, memorable incident for me. This was soon after I had, Swami had appointed me in the Sathya Sai Central Trust.
Okay.
We had drawn our first salary. And usually in India, it's a tradition that with our first salary, gifts for our, we offer it to our own parents. But here I took permission from my parents and I said, I'm going to give it to Swami first.
Okay.
And my friend also, he did the same. And both of us, we drew the cash, and put it in an envelope and handed it over to Swami. So Swami just, he took it with him and he went inside the interview room. So the next day, we were seated in the bhajan hall and Swami looked at us and he called us near him. And he said, go inside. So we went into the interview room. So Swami had a very stern face. He said, what is it that you all gave me yesterday? So my friend said, Swami, it was our first salary. We wanted to offer it to you. And then he smiled. He had been holding his hand behind his back.
Okay.
And he took out the exact R2 envelopes, handed mine to me and, you know, my friends to him. And he said, I don't want this money from you. And I remember with a choked voice, Swami saying, all I want is your love. That is all. And I can always, I'll never forget that particular incident. It drives me every single day to be of service to Swami, because that was all that he wanted. So
beautiful.
Pure.
Yeah. Beautiful, Ari. I think I shouldn't add anything to that and take away that beautiful moment which you narrated. It's so wonderful. And dear listeners, a couple of weeks back when we had Venkatraman sir here, you know, this is what he said. He said, when you listen to these discourses, when you listen to the amount of detail Swami is going into, amount of pain Swami is taking to explain all this, it only shows how much love Swami had. Because he had no reason to do all these other than the fact that he really loved us.
Yes.
And one real gratitude we can show to him is take these messages of Swami as our very life breath and live by it and try as much as possible. You know, it's not that we all live in that state of non-duality or live in the state of perfectly being ruled by the intellect, by the buddhi, as Swami would say. But it all is in Shraddha, as Swami said, you know, the words which Swami used here, Astha and Ashakti.
Yes, so as a mother who actually enjoys her child taking the first faltering step, but will finally actually hold us like a child, like a mother holding the child to itself, I'm pretty sure that Swami will one day look at us taking these faltering steps and hold us to his bosom.
Wonderful. Yeah. And with that prayer and with that promise to Swami, we offer this humble effort of ours at Swami's lotus feet and we pray that he blesses all of us. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishop's last segment of the day, Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me for the past 1 hour was Brother Harishankar from the Sri Sathya Sai Central Trust. Thank you for joining us. Happy listening.